This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Pete Stoughton.
Well, our neighborhood grocery store, you know, is one of the places outside of our home and work that we spend really a disproportionate amount of time. In fact, Pete, 2% of our lifetime for the average American is spent inside a grocery store.
And if I get lost, like I usually do, it feels like 3 or 4%.
And if you run into 10 people you know and haven't caught up with for a while, then it's...
double digits.
Exactly. Well, we've all walked to the aisles before and thought, should I really buy that pineapple from Central America in the dead of winter? What does fair trade mean? And is the word organic sort of watered down right about now? What does it take to run the American supermarket, and how do products get to the shelves? Author Benjamin Lohr pulls back the curtain on actually this highly secretive industry in his new book, The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Benjamin Lohr joins us by phone. Welcome to you, Benjamin. Great to have you on The Mountain Life.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Lynn and Pete.
Wow. What a book you have written, and what an investigation you've done. This took you years.
Yeah, it was a more of an undertaking than I knew when I began it. I knew I was fascinated with groceries. I knew that I felt like when I walked in a grocery store, there was something intuitively almost hallucinogenic about walking down the aisles, relaxing, soothing, but also like radiating with power. But the research process was long and intense, and I really threw myself in. I worked in a Whole Foods for a small portion. I traveled with truckers across the country. I went down to Thailand and Myanmar to go track down the way bottom of the community commodity chain. I broke into factory farms with activists to kind of verify the certification claims like fair trade and rainforest friendly. And it just kind of swallowed me up like any good rabbit hole that you bury into for research.
I love that, getting swallowed up by a rabbit hole. Well, when the outcome of it is a book and one by a very reputable publisher, I think it's a great thing. Well, you know, I'm interested. Let's start there, because you do talk about Thai shrimp. You talk about this commodity chain being very hidden, but it's massive. It's a billion-dollar complex of activity pumping 350,000 metric tons of shrimp into the world market each year. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say. I think the first thing to say is just to emphasize that 350 million metric tons. It's so much more than we can imagine in volume. And so I think there's this idea that the supply chain exists as this flow chart in some corporate PowerPoint. It's like from point A to B to C, and there's little nice neat arrows. And that is not the case in reality. To aggregate the amount of shrimp, and then if you go one layer down, fish meal to feed those shrimp, and then if you go one layer down below that, actual fish to create the fish meal, then get the protein in that fish meal. To aggregate all of those raw ingredients is an enormous undertaking, and it's something that involves many overlapping supply lines with aggregators and brokers at each step that buy from a disparate number of people, some of whom are good actors and some of whom are terrible actors. And what you don't have when you're at the way top at the grocery store level is visibility down. And that lack of visibility creates shelter for some of the worst impulses in human nature, because there is this cover. And so despite the best intentions up top, there can be some really horrific things on the bottom. And when I went to Thailand and Myanmar, it was in response to those. And I spent a lot of time with trafficked migrants and people who were, there's really no other word in the English language to describe it, but slaves on seafood boats They had been bought out of prison in some cases, or in some cases just used an unsavory labor broker who sold them onto these boats, and then were imprisoned on them, and often for months at a time before that boat would come back to land, forced to stay out there, work under the threat of beating. They saw people on the boats killed in front of them, and they were the labor that was at the way bottom of this, you know, that billion-dollar complex of activity you described in the beginning. Without them, there would be none of the raw materials that was going in. But at the same time, the visibility to see what boats were savory and good actors and upholding the law and which ones weren't is incredibly complicated thing, and not at all what I expected going into the book, where I kind of thought, oh, well, you know who you're buying from. And it's kind of like when I go to the store and buy something, I see this person right in front of me. But that's just not how it works.
And so much of our consumption has moved towards this conscientious consumption. And yet what your book and even the title, I'm a parent, so it kind of reminds me of Secret Life of Pets. You're trying to uncover this secret world that, unbeknownst to us, no matter our intentions and our conscientiousness, really is a scary world.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think what's interesting is it's because we have mixed intentions as consumers, even the most virtuous of us often, at the checkout counter and when we peruse the aisles, we're often very picky. We scan those ingredient lists. We want X, Y, and Z quality on it. We want fruit that is, you know, we squeeze all the fruit and choose the best one. And we want that level of choice with a continuous supply of that. So you get that pineapple in winter, but not just that pineapple in winter. You expect there to be a pineapple there if someone else has just come before you to the store and bought that pineapple in winter. There should be one other one in the back that's going to get out there to stock the shelf. And we expect low prices. And so in addition to all the certification labels that we want on it to guarantee that these things are ethically above board, we're asking for these other qualities that are not pieties that we verbalize. They're just things that we demand through action and by going to a different store if they're not there. And the market responds to those actions as best it can, and our pieties to the extent that we put action behind them. And as the case with certification regimes, often there's not a lot of substance to them, or not as much as we wish when we or imagine when we see them as a label on a product.
Ben, I hate to get to conclusions so quickly in our interview, but are you suggesting that it's part of our nature as consumers where we are so demanding of the quality and the choice and our own autonomy that is perhaps the underpinning and the underlying conditions for this system, which is problematic?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's clear to me. The question is, does it have to be that way? And can we channel our pickiness and completely understandable, deeply hard to extricate ourselves from selfishness from a framework where you know, do those impulses have to lead to these terrible ends? And I think it really points to there are bigger structural issues outside of food that this rests up on. And this is, now we're getting way deep into the book, and there's a lot more fun parts of the book than this. But I think, you know, there are a lot of structural reasons why we enable those worst impulses to have big effects, from like labor laws that aren't enforced to international treaties with no teeth to, you know, disempowering unions to the lack of wage floors to the lack of standards of living around the world where people don't feel free to leave jobs because to leave the job would mean abject poverty in some of these places, certainly in Myanmar where I was visiting, there was no other opportunities out there. And so that their choice to become migrants was not an irrational choice at all. It was a choice that was made by people who are trying to survive. And as long as those structures are in place, the good intentions they don't stand a chance against the all the other impulses.
Well, I'm so grateful for you bringing to light in your text and again on this interview, sometimes the unintended consequences of really well-intended people can really be larger and deeper than we ever expect. And I work currently in the industry of food rescue and see that in very much its reality, where we see, the stores do not want to have two apples out or a loaf of bread, and so they have to restock the whole aisle, and that creates this mass system where billions of loaves of bread go to waste, and billions of loaves of bread need to be created that are organic or non-organic or blue or green, whatever that might be. You don't have to speak on that, just what we see also in our community. Perhaps, maybe on a brighter light, you can give us one of those more illustrative moments that maybe create humor for our audience, such as in Secret Life of Pets, where, the bunny is dancing and creating, an empire of snakes and other animals.
No, I think what you're saying about food waste is exactly right. And it's really at the crux of this dilemma because, the amount of food waste is staggering. And it's not something I go into in the book because I think other people have really covered it well. But anyone who looks at the system for even a blink will see there's waste on the farm level, then there's waste in the factory, the warehousing level, and then there's waste in the store level, and it gets stacked on top of each other. But it's all in service of this continuous delivery of product and of pristine product, which these are opposing virtues, and it's easy to become scoldy and say like, oh, all this food waste, and kind of get like a, you can't leave this table until you've cleaned your plate approach. But it's deeper than that. The industry is only doing that because it's trying to respond deeply to what people are asking from it. I guess to put some humor into it is just to appreciate the bounty that this is. And I think it's something we've taken for granted up until COVID, maybe help people see it. But when the first supermarkets, so supermarkets are American as apple pie, jazz, the T-shirt, it's a true American invention, which sounds weird to say. You don't think of a store as being an invention, but it didn't exist before. There were much smaller things to general stores. But when the first American style supermarkets, came overseas, this was late in the game, 1956, a small 2,500, product supermarket opened in Rome as part of a USDA exhibition. And the Roman families would go shopping there, lost their minds. They had never seen anything like this before. And, there was press there at the opening, and they reported this one woman running up and down the aisle screaming, "This must be heaven," at the top of her lungs. And other people just standing around stunned, goggle-eyed, and just shrieking with delight. And it is something that I don't want lost in the I really tried to stay even-handed with the book. The supermarket is a true miracle, and we are deeply dependent on it, and it enriches our life in a way that is never been seen before in the human project. You go back 500 years and people would have thought that we were God strolling down these aisles with pushing our cart and being able to get basically whatever we want to cook the most obscure meal day of, at the low prices. Americans pay the least for food for their income of anyone on the planet. So there is this like miraculous sense that I think is a key anchor point.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with author Benjamin Lohr. His book is The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. And Benjamin, it seems to me that as consumers, you know, I mean, as Pete's sort of been asking you, you know, is it chicken or egg? Can the consumer demand and really create a new wave of how supermarkets are formed, how supermarkets are stocked, and even to a certain degree, what, you know, how this food comes to us? And a big topic that you talk about in the book is the trucking industry. So many things I had no idea of. But going back to the consumer, was it the consumer that asked and for and demanded the whole fair trade come about? Maybe you can talk to us a little bit about fair trade and what it means and, well, what it really means.
Well, these are really deep questions you're asking, and I can't say I have an answer to them. I think the idea of like how much of this is supply side and how much of this is demand side is real tricky. I mean, on one hand, the supermarket is dying to serve its customers. It is racing to try to read the mind of the customers and respond. And that is why you see this big growth in organics and fair trade labeling, because people wanted it. It didn't exist 40 years ago in any meaningful fashion. And now it does in a really meaningful fashion. Now Walmart can be the number one seller of organics. So there is a demand side component. On the other hand, the structure of the grocery store, that miraculous invention, is not set up to ever fully be a sustainable. I think when you really get down to it, you would have to make structural changes to our expectations and to the in-store experience to really reform that. And I think I wrote the book pushing the foodie discourse a little towards the demand side. I think prior to me, and I certainly grew up with this, there was this idea that there are these big, greedy, evil corporations serving us plastic food that we're beholden to as, you know, as consumers, and we have little choice. And these big, greedy corporations are running industrial food. And there's a lot of truth to that critique, and I don't want to undermine it too much. But it's not the world of the grocery store with 1.5% margins, up to 3% margins. That's just not, they're not big greedy corporations that are stockpiling huge margins. That's not how they operate. And they are desperate to serve people. So I kind of wanted to push that back into the discourse with the book, which is to say that it's tricky, and I don't know to the extent that I got it right, but it's something that I think is important.
There's so many
So
there are just so many directions that you go in this book. I feel like I have about 56 more questions for you, but I guess what would be interesting to me right now as consumers. You know, what can we do to influence what shows up in our supermarket? And I know the simple things like you probably shouldn't buy Chilean grapes in the dead of winter and, things like that. I often think, I mean, bananas, we get, 100% of them from Central America. I don't know. I'm just guessing. But I always think, well, if I buy organic bananas, wouldn't that suggest that the workers are going to be healthier in those banana plantations? What are some of those tips as consumers that we ought to be following that you learned in this investigation?
Yeah. Well, I don't think buying organic will necessarily have anything to do with the labor standards there, or not in a material fashion. It's tricky. So again, we have to go to structural things, I think, really came out of this. So the certification regime for a lot of those things, like the common, rainforest-friendly fair trade, runs on an audit system, which is, born of the best intentions, but turn into this $50 billion for-profit industry that really doesn't measure up when it comes to delivering on those promises. It just can't, especially with ethical claims that can't be sampled in an empirical fashion. You have to go to these places and you're auditing them. So it's a snapshot to begin with. And then you're asking people about the labor practices in a globalized world where people speak many different languages and these are huge factories and there's no enforcement. It's just not a system to set up to deliver on those promises. It is set up to reassure the consumer. So this was very troubling to me as someone who does often pay, willing to pay extra for those labels. So to get to your question as to what can we do about it, it gets to a structural level. I think we have to shift from the stakeholders and employees, find companies that really treat them as shareholders in the company and not as laborers. When the way the commodity game works and the first world buyer is always asking for a lower price, but demanding the same high standards of quality, labor is the place where cuts happen. And so companies that are set up with just classic labor model, they're always going to be caught in a race to the bottom, where if you can really rethink things and you have cooperatives and you have laborers who are shareholders in the company themselves, there's a lot of hope there, especially if you get whole categories where that's true. But again, these are very complicated issues, and I don't think that there are simple solutions I can say where you can, like, I would be lying to you in the same way that the auditors are lying to you if I said you can go to the grocery store and make these five easy things and you'll create a better world. In general, I think the idea that we can create a better world through our purchasing habits is a bit of a vanity statement. Like, if we're going to create a better world, it's probably going to be through big policy changes, reforming trade, treaties and, you know, big structural changes. It's not probably going to be doing through something that's self-serving, like buying something nice for ourselves and maybe spending a few extra pennies on that to feel good about it on top of buying something nice for ourselves.
Well, I think you also bring something that's a challenge to our community, to every community that is listening, that, you know, the biggest change is where we can start with ourselves. And maybe we need to reevaluate and challenge ourselves. Can we be okay with not being comfortable when we go to the grocery store? Can we be okay with an empty shelf? Can we be okay picking maybe the last apple or orange? And if we were okay with that, to start there, or paying more, you know, that might be part of the challenge that we need to start before
yes.
we go to policy.
Yeah, man, I just want to echo and raise that up. I think that's exactly right. And it's not how we're trained to think as consumers. Trained is a hard word. I'm not sure if it's even accurate. It goes against some deep impulses that we've been brought up with. But I think you're absolutely right. Some of these things are very internal, and it's easy to blame forces above us that are and different from us, but it's much harder to look at what we do.
So in an ideal world, you know, when we walked into a grocery store, what would it look like for you in this dystopia of experience?
I don't know. I think it would be stocked with products that were made from worker owned or worker shareholded, with workers or shareholders, cooperatives. I think it would exist as itself in a world that had salary floors and a safety net for workers, and in a world where there was a lot of effort to alleviate global poverty and prevent wealth gaps between different countries, which of course pushes people into these migratory patterns that can then be turned into extremely exploitative places when they are illegal and have no recourses or what places to turn. So I don't even know if the in-store experience is where I would begin.
but you could start there. Like,
I guess the products on the shelves would be different.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say is, you know, when I want to create some Thai dish or put star fruit on my, you know, summer medley, but it's winter in Park City, Utah, maybe I need to reconsider. Or if, you know, there's only two apples and I needed four apples for my apple cobbler and, you know, this is, you know, April, you know, that might be being okay with, I guess, you know, I've been calling it failure or not meeting expectation or, redesigning my expectations. So I love your book. I love the challenges.
Yeah, I think that's part of it.
That you're bringing to us in our community, and great job putting together a challenge to the world. So thank you so much.
Hey, thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The book is The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Benjamin Lohr is our guest. Thanks, Benjamin. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. If you missed part of the show or want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab. We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows. Wherever you find your podcasts, you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW The Mountain Life and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.